Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Right now, it's The First Time with Neil Hannon.
Hello. Ooh.
Something in the woodshed, and I can hear it breathing. It's such an eerie feeling, darling. He said, there's nothing in the woodshed. It's your imagination, end of the conversation.
And welcome, I'm Matt Everett, this is Six Music, and this is The First Time, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest is a singer and songwriter whose avowed intent was to blend Morrissey, Scott Walker and ELO, something he achieved with his band The Divine Comedy. And he's gone on to work in opera, soundtracks and theatre, all the time preserving his idiosyncratic, charming and wry style. I'm pleased to welcome to The First Time, Neil Hannon. Here Neil chats about his early musical loves, which started with Bagpuss, and his deep-seated passion for the ambitious prog of ELO and the 80s pop of Nick Kershaw, all of which gave way to his love of indie, and especially the Pixies. He also discusses falling in love with the music of Scott Walker, a massive influence on his songwriting and his band, the chamber pop group The Divine Comedy. And Neil looks back over his group's success in the mid-90s, during which time they released hits like Becoming More Like Alfie and Something for the Weekend, and of course, National Express. Since the group disbanded, Neil has worked with Air and Charlotte Gainsbourg and indulged his passion for Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Vile, as well as providing vocals for music on Doctor Who shows and recording his acclaimed cricket concept album, The Duckworth Lewis Method. Oh yes, and we cover in detail Neil's world-famous song, My Lovely Horse, from the sitcom Father Ted. And I started by asking Neil, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I was aware of the wonderful harp on Bagpuss. Although it probably wasn't a harp, it was probably a piano being played on the strings. Jungle Book was my first enormous sort of, you know, frenzied musical obsession. And we had a record player and I just used to play the Bare Necessities over and over again. And I still think it's genius.
Look for the Bare Necessities, the simple Bare Necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the Bare Necessities are Mother Nature's recipes that bring the Bare Necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be found off my big home. The bees are buzzing in the tree to make some honey just for me. When you look under the rocks and plants and take a glance at the fancy ants, then maybe try a few. The bare necessities of life will come to you. They'll come to you. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities. That's why a bear can rest at ease with just the bare necessities of life. Now when you pick a pawpaw or a prickly pear, and you prick a raw paw, well next time beware. Don't pick the prickly pear by the paw. When you pick a pear, try to use the claw. But you don't need to use the claw when you pick a pear of the big pawpaw. Have I given you a clue? The bare necessities of life will come to you. They'll come to you. So just try and relax, yeah, cool it, fall apart in my backyard. Cause let me tell you something, little wretches, if you act like that bee acts, you're working too hard. And don't spend your time looking around for something you want that can't be found. When you find out you can live without it and go along not thinking about it, I'll tell you something true. The bare necessities of life will come to you. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean a bare necessity. That's why a bear can rest at ease with just the bare necessities of life.
yeah, with just the bare necessities of life.
Yeah, man.
Was it quite a musical household that you were brought up in?
It was reasonably musical. My father plays the piano quite well. And he used to play, especially before Sunday service, to sort of calm his nerves. After finishing his sermon, he'd go in and you'd just hear sort of pleasantly romantic music coming from the drawing room. What a bourgeois middle-class household I came from. I have two elder brothers, the eldest of which sort of introduced me to the joys of the Electric Light Orchestra early on. And, you know, whether I like it or not, it's in my very being, all of that stuff. So that's hence the huge strings and choirs and what have you.
So that's where it came from, do you think? That huge orchestral, the production?
Yeah, that and being in church choirs and such like. And also just liking classical music, as well as all the pop music that was going on. You know, chained to the television 7:30 every Thursday for Top of the Pops. It was a fun time.
What was the first single that you owned that was yours, not maybe something that your brother had inspired you to buy?
I bought two singles at the same time, I remember. One was Vienna, Ultravox, which is pretty cool.
Very cool.
And the other was Flash by Queen, which I'm not quite so proud of. But
I don't know, though. It's a pretty out there track.
Yeah, but then I ruined it all because I think the next week I went and bought Rat Rapping by Roland Rat. I was quite young.
What was it about Vienna that really that appealed to you?
Well, that had everything I desire and probably everything, you know, that I still kind of live for, which is sort of the grandiosity of classical music, if there is such a word, and, you know, out and out synth pop, 3 minute classic pop tunes. Yeah.
We walked in the cold air. Freezing breath on a window pane, lying and waiting. A man in the dark in a picture frame, so mystic and soulful. A voice reaching out in a piercing cry, it stays with you until.
Did music hold an allure for you? Did you find yourself wanting to be part of that world? Either the image or the sounds or...
Yeah.
Do you think about it romantically, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I only really had two sort of ideas of what I wanted to do in life. The first one was car designer. I think it was something to do with the DeLorean factory that had opened near us at the time. And then just as soon as I wrote my first song in my head, which was called Digital Watch, because they were all the rage at the time.
How did it go?
Walking down the street, want to know the time, I look at my watch, look at my wrist, I've got a digital watch. And it was played on the tennis racket.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I took it from there.
Other than Ultravox, what were your overreaching first musical obsessions? Because you mentioned watching Top of the Pops, and that's often a place where you used to sort of see an artist and just become...
Yeah.
Not just the music, the image, the whole...
Absolutely. I mean, I remember Top of the Pops from glam and disco. So I was about 3 or 4 when I first recall the imagery and just thinking, well, that's quite exciting, but also a little scary. And kind of when I finally started buying music, it was Human League and OMD, and I was just madly into the synth pop. But then it all went terribly wrong in the early 80s. Music did go wrong a bit at that time. And I was into Nick Kershaw, heavily into Nick Kershaw.
Right.
And his, you know, 30 unnecessary chords. Yeah, big country I liked. But then gradually, as the 80s wore on, I became the archetypal indie kid. R.E.M., Pixies, My Bloody Valentine, Cure, Smiths, all of them.
If they don't believe me now, will they ever believe me? And if they don't believe me now, will they ever, believe me? Oh, no. Oh, 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 oh.
And then, you know, the next life-changing moment was when I got the Best of the Walker Brothers and Scott Walker in, like, 89 or 90. And that was pretty much all of my influences sealed by that stage.
What would be the archetypal Walker Brothers or Scott Walker track that you remember hearing and thinking, yes, that's it, that makes sense?
It is Scott's version of Jackie by Jacques Brel, which, I mean, I was more excited than I can tell you when I heard that, because suddenly it's like, this is so glorious and driving, and the lyrics are so romantic and yet very sort of dirty and kitchen sink drama, and it's just an explosion of imagination. It's brilliant.
And if one day I should become a singer with a Spanish bum who sings for women of great virtue, I'd sing to them with a guitar I borrowed from a coffee bar. Well, what you don't know doesn't hurt you. My name would be Antonio, and all my bridges I would burn. And when I gave them some, they'd know I'd expect something in return. I'd have to get drunk every night and talk about virility with some old grandmama who might be decked out like a Christmas tree. And though pink elephants I'd see, though I'd be drunk as I could be, still I would sing my song to me about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute, cute, in a stupid-ass way. And if I joined the social world, became procurer of young girls, then I would have my own bordellos. My record would be number one, and I'd sell records by the ton, all sung by many other fellows. My name would then be Handsome Jack, and I'd sell boats of opium, whiskey that came from Twickenham, off many queers and phony virgins. If I had banks on every finger, finger in every country, and all the countries ruled by me, I'd still know where I'd want to be. Locked up inside my opium den, surrounded by some Chinamen, I'd sing the song that I sang then about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, cute, cute, in a stupid-ass way. Now tell me, wouldn't it be nice that if one day in paradise I'd sing for all the ladies up there, and they would sing along with me, we'd be so happy there to be, 'cause down below is really nowhere. And if my name were Juniper, then I would know where I was going, and then I would become all-knowing, my beard so very long and dumb and blind, because I pitied all mankind and broke my heart to make things right, I'd know that every single night. When my angelic work was through, the angels and the devil too would sing my childhood song to me about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute, cute, in a stupid-ass way.
What about your first gigs? Can you remember going to gigs as a punter?
The first gig I went to, weirdly, was U2, the Joshua Tree, in Croke Park in Dublin.
That's a pretty big gig.
It's a big gig. And it was, you know, for a 16-year-old, just religious. You know, you were there to pay due homage to the gods of Irish rock.
These city walls, these
And then after that, it got a bit cooler. You know, I'd go up to Belfast and see Ride, Teenage Fan Club.
Oh, funny.
Sonic Youth and stuff like that, yeah. For about 10 years, I was sadly telling everybody that I wish I'd seen the Pixies live because they're, you know, just one of my favourite bands. And then rummaging around in the attic one day, I found the ticket that I'd had to go and see the Pixies. I must have just got really drunk because I completely forgot. And sure enough, when I got the ticket, I thought, oh yeah, Bleach were supporting. And I remember that. God, how embarrassing.
Name a Pixies song that you love.
Actually, Planet of Sound is one of my favourites from Trompe Le Monde, late period Pixies, but really stonking.
You're listening to The First Time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Neil Hannon.
Six Music. Six.
Hi, I'm Matt Everett. Welcome back to the first time here on Six Music with my guest, Neil Hannon, singer, songwriter, composer and band leader of the Divine Comedy, talking us through the music that's defined his life.
1989 was the first time the Divine Comedy kind of name got used, I believe. And that first release, Fanfare for the Comic Muse, was something that you've since distanced yourself from.
Well, I don't distance myself from it.
It's a dramatic way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I did it. It's my fault. But, you know, it was the first outing on record. And, you know, it just wears its schoolboy influences on its sleeve. And it's not particularly well played. And it's just a bit rubbish. But it's interesting as a period piece, you know. But I wouldn't, you know, I didn't really think the songs were much good as time went on. Whereas, you know, the first full-length album, Liberation, was kind of where I thought I'd got it right at last, you know, and I took it from there. So I look upon that as the first proper record.
Which is the track off that record, do you think, that's managed to achieve everything that you wanted it to achieve?
I think Bernice Bobs Her Hair is a nice one off Liberation. It sort of tells a story, which I robbed off F. Scott Fitzgerald, and, you know, your harpsichord and pop sensibilities in a very indie-schmindy kind of way.
Bernice bobs her hair in the barbers in the square. All her newfound friends are there to see it done. Bernice bobs her hair, she's been driven to despair. Her cousin doesn't care about anyone. Her hair was loud, her hair was dark, her hair fell down her back, and now it lies upon the floor, and he swans out the
door. 1996, Casanova, the album gave you your first hit. Something for the Weekend, I think it would be fair to call that your first hit. What do you remember about recording that?
I remember the recording sessions for Casanova being long and tortuous. Edwin Collins had thankfully had a massive hit for Satanta, my record company at the time, and Keith just used all the money on my record, which is shameful, but it was great for me, I have to say. And Something for the Weekend, I remember I'd written a particularly high trumpet part where it goes at the end of the line, and the guy said, I can't play that, it's too high. And I had to actually bribe him to try, you know. I think we said, 50 quid if you can make it. And of course he did. Yeah.
When in doubt, just throw money at the problem.
Yeah.
If that was your first hit, then National Express was your first top 10 hit.
And last.
1999. Was the subject matter inspired by a personal experience?
It was. I was on National Express down to see my brother's family, and I was dragging along with me a girlfriend who was from France, and I think I was seeing everything through her eyes in a way. You know, I've got nothing against that particular company, and it's, you know, it's good, honest transport.
Absolutely.
But it was just interesting seeing all the various types, and the poor guy struggling on with the pram, you know, and trying to fit it in the overhead rack. Yeah, and the lady who literally was in the wrong job, you know, she couldn't get down the aisle with her trolley. But, you know, it's not as some crazy journalists at the time sort of anti-working class or something like that. It was literally just everyday observation.
On the National Express, there's a jolly hostess selling crisps and tea. She'll provide you with drinks and theatrical winks for a sky. Danced
you enjoy the attention and the acclaim that started to kind of pile up at that point?
Yes. I've never had a problem with attention and acclaim, only with the lack of it. Although
hatred and ignorance, not so good at.
Exactly. But then, you know, I've never run close to it being a problem in my ordinary life. You know, I've always been able to walk happily down the street in blissful anonymity. I think I've had just about the right amount of interest from the general public. Just enough to make you feel wanted and not too much to annoy you.
Appreciate it.
Exactly. It's lovely.
You mentioned ELO earlier, and I think this was about the time that Mr. Blue Sky became kind of part of your live set, the kind of big finale that you you did with the whole, with the strings and the orchestras and everything. When did your love affair with that song start? You mentioned it was your brother's.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Blue Sky was the anthem when I was 8 years old. It never left me. It's kind of crazy, and I'm not sure that lyrically Jeff was ever the greatest, but it's just a great tune. Yeah, we only played it about twice, I think, with orchestra. On those gigs, Royal Festival Hall and then Paris, La Cigale. In Paris, it was being recorded for the radio. And, you know, there's a vocoder section. Well, they didn't realize it was meant to be the channel through the vocoder, and they just took Pinky's vocal straight. And obviously, being a vocoder, he wasn't paying any attention to the pitch. So in the middle of this song, you have Mr. Blue Sky live on the radio. Brilliant.
How did you first get involved with the makers of Father Ted? Because you composed the theme music and, of course, the epic composition known as
My Lovely Horse.
Yes.
Which will follow me to the grave.
Of course
it will. Yeah, it was very simple. Graham Linehan, half of the writing team with Arthur Matthews, he'd been a music journalist and he'd reviewed my first couple of records very favourably. Thank you very much, Graham. And I think I may have been a few names down the list of hopefuls, but I got a phone call.
David Bowie, Lou Reed. No, okay. Neil.
That Divine Comedy bloke. And yeah, he just said, do you think you could have a bash at writing some theme music for us? And I went, yeah, that might be fun. I mean, nobody knew what it was going to be like or whether it would be successful. I was just insanely lucky to get the gig, you know. Interesting story. We recorded it in a studio owned by the Jesus and Mary chain in South London. And I just took any instruments that were lying about and I played the big guitar line on one of Jim's favourite lovely semi-acoustic Fenders. So it's basically the coolest indie rock guitar being put to terrible use.
You said that My Lovely Horse is going to follow you to your grave. I guess that's almost the price you pay for doing something that hits the note so perfectly and that people love so much.
Mm. It was odd because, you know, I was literally given the lyrics. You know, it's not, I didn't write the words. I can't take credit for the insanity there. Given the lyric, and I thought, yeah, I can do something with that. Eurovision. But it has to be vaguely what you'd expect Ted and Dougal to achieve. But then again, it also had to be something they'd ripped off from a Norwegian entry back in the 70s. So it was an interesting little conundrum. And I knocked it out in about half an hour.
You did a number of interesting, you have done a number of interesting collaborations, including stuff with Air. Do you find yourself comfortable when you put yourself in musical situations that maybe normally people wouldn't expect you to be in?
I'm essentially quite shy. You wouldn't think it from various pictures I've had taken. I find collaborations quite hard, certainly to begin with. I always feel like, what the hell am I doing here in amongst these gods, you know?
He's a proper musician.
Exactly. I mean, Air, one of my favourite ever bands, and we were making the music for Charlotte Gainsbourg's record with Nigel Godrich producing, and it's just so much heavyweight, you know, stuff going on. I was trying to write sort of these clever rhyme schemes. And, you know, Nigel was going, I like this line out of like 60 lines. So it took a while. And when I finally ran out, they got Jarvis in. get in the lyrical troubleshooter.
I saw somebody who reminded me of you before you got. Girl, I stopped and smiled at her. She screamed and ran away. It happens to me more and more these days. And these songs that you sing, do they mean anything to the people you're singing to? A woman in a bath of $100 bills. If the cold doesn't kill her, none will. I read a magazine that said by 17 your life was at an end. I'm dead and I'm perfectly content. And these songs that I sing, do they mean to the people I'm singing them to? People like you.
How did you get involved in the world of Doctor Who? This is something that kind of turned up when I was doing some research for this, because you've done some Who music. How does one?
Well, I didn't really. The lovely fellow who makes the music for Doctor Who just kindly asked me to sing on a couple of tracks.
Well, I roamed about this earth with just a suitcase in my hand, and I've met some bug-eyed Joes, I've met the blessed, I've met the damned. But of all the strange, strange creatures in the air, at sea, on land, oh my girl, my girl, my precious girl, I love you, you understand. So reel me in, my precious girl, or come on, take me home, 'cause my body's tired of traveling and my heart don't wish to roam. No, no. I have wandered, I have rambled, I have crossed this crowded sphere, and I've seen a mess of problems that I long to disappear.
I wasn't entirely sure about it, but then, you know, my childhood self, you know, slapped me firmly and said, you're going to be on Doctor Who, you got to do it. So I did it. I just did a couple of vocals, and my nieces were just amazed and astonished. But to be honest, you know, I don't really watch the new ones, I have to say. My girlfriend loves them. Anyway, I'm sure they're great.
You mentioned Eurovision earlier, and I have to ask you about this as well. You're recording what you described as being the perfect Eurovision song, Trafalgar, which has once again sort of taken on a life of its own. Was Eurovision always an obsession with you? Can you remember first seeing it as a kid and being kind of transfixed by that kind of pop music? Because it's very different. It's very different to any kind of other music.
One looks upon Eurovision as a kind of a technical, you know, thing, an analysis of what people are doing to try and achieve some kind of impact in the very short slot that they have. You look back at old Eurovisions, you know, from the 60s and 70s, and they're really quite good. You know, there's a lot of good stuff there. There's a lot of insanely silly stuff. But in the last couple of years, I've really quite enjoyed them again. I think that they've got a handle on, you know, what they're really trying to do, which is amuse and delight and have a catchy tune.
This is something that beats strong in your heart, isn't it? No matter how far the art gets or how far the, not the pretension, but the ambition of music gets, it must keep a pop sensibility.
Well, I can't deny my upbringing. And I like a good tune. And I like a well-crafted pop song, but I also like them to be interesting, and so that's pretty much all you need to know about me.
Marionette, I'll do whatever you like. I'm not someone you forget. I'm just like riding a bike, and I don't mind getting wet. Although I'd rather be dry, I'm getting caught in your net. This feels a little.
So we've had all these firsts, so the last thing is to ask you to choose the last song, which can be anything you want. It can be something from your back catalogue, something from a hero of yours.
What about Pulp? I'm a singles man. You know, Common People is that enormous single of the classic Different Class. And Jarvis Cocker is one of the cleverest, best lyricists ever. And what's not to like, really? It's a driving, overly long, tumultuous sort of tirade, and it really works for me, even though I'm probably the enemy in terms of the lyric.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College, that's where I... She told
live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. What else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see whatever common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand. I went to the flagship of the shop. I cut your hair.
Some fool, pretend. is BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.